Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 47, titled Two Kinds of Bodhicitta.
So then bodhicitta, then that topic. Then bodhicitta has two kinds. It's called ultimate bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta, or absolute bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta. Absolute bodhicitta is emptiness, actually, and particularly, of course, therefore, the awareness of emptiness, knowledge of emptiness, experience of emptiness. And which is the ultimate healing thing, of course. And it's not ultimate in the sense when someone achieves it, because it's a relative achievement, to become aware of what the ultimate condition of things is, which is this clear light or transparency or infinite energy. But very importantly, infinite energy of the void, which means that by itself it's not doing anything. But yet it's a plenum that can be drawn on infinitely by any relative being who needs something, if you follow me. So it's a best of both worlds. It's not like some absolute entity is interfering with anything, because it's already permeating everything, so it doesn't need to interfere with everything. But the ignorant people who don't know that they're permeated by that, then they can draw from it. Or those who do know can draw from it whatever they need to help those who don't know discover that. You know? And then that's the relative bodhicitta, is the compassion that is the same thing as that wisdom experience. Or intuition experience. Intuition is a very important word in this. And that's the relative bodhicitta, which is the love and compassion for all beings, which in its ultimate form is most powerful when one is enlightened. Enlightenment is the complete embodiment and manifestation of that compassion, which of course is reality itself, is compassionate to beings. In that it's their own lack of need for suffering, if you will. That's what ultimate reality is that nobody needs to suffer. But ignorance of that makes those who are ignorant of that then somehow manage to suffer anyway. But luckily their suffering is less real than their real condition, which is bliss. So therefore there's hope for every being, even those in hell, actually, in whatever hell might be. And there's some beings who don't have hell. The Buddhas there choose not to. They shape it in another way, but that's another story. So I don't want to confuse you. So the Buddhas are not absolutely omnipotent at all, either. Any relative bodhicitta is not omnipotent. Because the problem with compassion, that compassion has, in spite of drawing on infinite energy, is that infinite energy by itself does not cure others' ignorance. Because they have to cure it themselves by their understanding. And just flooding them with energy, if they're paranoid, makes them more tight, actually, and freaked out, and more boundaried, and more averse. So you just, you know, Buddha's big frustration in the morning of his enlightenment, or any Buddha's frustration in the morning of his or her enlightenment, since they're a female Buddha. And there must be neuter ones, too, him, her, or it. And but the big frustration is, gee whiz, I can't bomb the universe into bliss. There's no need to actually, because it already is bliss. But so I have to skillfully open doors for beings to expand their own understanding to their own reality, you follow me? Mm-hmm. So there's tremendous skill involved, and tremendous art, actually. The next transcendent virtue, Paramita, after the wisdom one, the sixth one, the seventh one is called the art Paramita, Upaya. The word upaya is kind of pedestrianly translated, skillful means, by people. And they put skillful because they don't like to say means because it sounds mean. It has a kind of dumb, connotation. But actually what that is art. And having upaya, and the skillful word is sometimes connected with it, which is kaushalya. But upaya itself doesn't mean skill, it just means art. But art is, it must be skillful, artful, right? And healing is art, and everything like that is art. So when he said that's the ultimate way of dealing with spirits is because the clear light of the void, or the clear light transparency, as I prefer to use the word, but you have to start with clear light because everybody knows clear light. So because the people, when they hear clear light, they think it's a light, like a bright light. But a bright light is the opposite of darkness and casts shadows. But clear light, and there are very bright lights when you release your body and when you go into the deeper, the deepest level of your super subtle body-mind. They're very bright solar, billion suns and moonlight, you know, and then a big darkness. There are these three states. If you read your inquiry reading in Book of the Dead, you saw that subtle mind and super subtle mind. But the transparency itself is beyond light and dark. So it's a kind of, the main emphasis in the expression clear light is the clarity, not really the light part. It's, you follow me? It's gray. In honor of it, I'm wearing a gray shirt this weekend, and which is a combination of light and dark, which is important too, because yin-yang, you know, yang is bright, and the male associates themselves with bright, you know, and they think the female is dark, and that's not good. Although they are properly humble, or they should be, these materialist scientists, but the thing about 3% of the universe is this bright thing that you can see, 97% is dark energy and dark matter. I mean, that might be a bit humbling if they were humbleable. And the reason that that's the most powerful thing is that's grounded in reality. That's reality itself, is the ultimate bodhicitta, and that it is what energizes, provides energy, or the energy is drawn from, for the relative bodhicitta, which is the love and compassion for all beings, which is generated by, which is said to be a Mahayana focus, but it's every form of Buddhism. For example, in Theravada Buddhism, which doesn't emphasize it as much because it doesn't lay the sort of messianic duty on people who are too self-centered and want to think that enlightenment is where they escape from all duty and obligation in some blissful place. You know, they want to escape themselves. And they don't want to think that they escape into taking full responsibility for this place, blissfully, of course, but still without being able to leave. And they would be overwhelmed by that idea. So he teaches like that. But still, the enlightenment is described as, before attaining nirvana, he remembers infinite previous lives of himself. And then he becomes aware of everyone else's infinite previous lives. Okay, so if we've all had infinite previous lives and you have a visceral experience of that, what that means is you realize you've been everything to everyone else and they've been everything to you, and you are universally and infinitely entangled with everyone. And it's like a run. And then the second thing is he realized all their future possible destinies, which are not fixed yet, because it's not like karma is a fate. It's an evolutionary process. But he became aware that they have these various possibilities. And then the infinite compassion of an enlightened being is to make them achieve their own enlightenment as fast and as evolutionarily optimally as possible, rather than delay a long time, many, many like suffering lives, right? To change that future for them as much as you can without being omnipotent, if you follow me. So I call it omnicompetent. You know? So that's in the Theravada. But people don't usually think about the implications of that. That those two realizations were a realization of that he is really one with all beings. That all life is one, actually. Totally entangled forever. So therefore, that enlightenment itself, just like clear light of the void, is naturally committed to everyone else's enjoyment of their own true nature, which is that blissful freedom. Right? So that's why he meant that's the most powerful thing. And I agree with that. And that brings up one thing I'm concerned with, I'll come at it from my own problem as a translator nowadays. The word siddhi. Siddha comes from a verb sad, to achieve, to make real, or to achieve, or to attain. And siddhi, that the I suffix in Sanskrit means possessing, siddha, so possessing attainment or achievement. But then some translators use the word siddhi. Because, you know, it's like people run around going bodhicitta, bodhicitta. And then it's kind of an in-group where they learn something, then it becomes very meaningful to people. And but then the really annoying thing is that when they spell it with a C, which is either bodhicitta or bodhicitta, and not cha, unless you're Italian. And that's really irritating to me. But, you know, because you have to translate it. You know, if there is, there are, there should be, or we have to make new words or take old words that are close and create a new meaning, like seventh meaning, Buddhist meaning of whatever it is. And I prefer spirit, actually. Although Italians don't like that, because spirito can mean a ghost in Italian. You know? A bank, and even a bank, the bank of the Holy Ghost. You know, it's a corrupt bank of the Vatican that Francis, dear Pope Francis, is trying to clean up, the Holy Ghost bank. And I don't really like the whole, but so the spirito means like that, you know, as well as what we think of as spirit, you know. And it can, spirit can mean a ghost to us too, actually. But it isn't that strong a connotation for us, as some Italians that I know who get annoyed when I say spirit of enlightenment. But I actually think that is still the best translation in English, personally. But anyway, but my other thing is the, how to translate siddhi, or not just use. You can say attainment, and you can say power. And we do say both. And lately, I'm inclining to power. But then what is power? What do we mean by power? You know, Henry Kissinger? Do you know what I'm saying? Power is a tricky word. And I think there are levels of meaning in power. If you use power for siddhi, which means in possession of an attainment, they have two kinds. One is called mundane power, and the other is called the supreme power. Supreme power, again, is Buddhahood, you know, where you've realized the clear light of you're conscious at the clear light, super subtle level, as well as any other level of manifestation you choose. Which is why you can make any kind of manifestation that you want. Because you're conscious at the constitutive subatomic level. There's a marvelous thing in the fifth chapter of the Kala Chakra that I'm hoping to finish publishing with my colleagues. We'll get over. I fixed it, but then they're unfixing it. We'll get it. But anyway, there's a huge 20-page or 30-page thing in Sanskrit in which Pundarika, who's one of the kings of Shambhala many centuries ago, and who is Avalokiteshvara incarnation. I think he's really connected to Dalai Lama. Why Dalai Lama was able to do so many Kala Chakras, I think. But anyway, that's my opinion. But anyway, he has a huge argument in there with people. You know, he brings up and he debates with that Buddha's body has no atoms. And others are thinking that the coarse body of a Buddha has atoms. But he's saying, no, it doesn't. And it's a very fascinating one. And, you know, the idea that there's a level of where reality really is shaped is at an energy level that is non-atomic, where mind and matter are not differentiated and there's no coarse atom or particle. But particles are sort of a meso level of where some ordinary people see it. It's like a bottom level of the coarse atom. Very interesting.